Hey there, and welcome to episode number 292 of Marvel by the Month, the no prize winning podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics and the events that shape them one month at a time. In this episode, that month is May 1977. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Milne.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
Our guest this week is comics journalist and podcaster David Harper. We've got three great issues to talk about with him. We're going to talk about the first appearance of a major future X-Men foe in Iron Fist number 14. A heaping helping of Steve Gerber madness in Howard the Duck number 15.
Awesome.
And the conclusion of Jim Shooter and George Perez's first major story arc in Avengers 162. Our patrons are listening to the extended version of this episode where they get to hear about all of those plus another 28 Marvel comics from May of 1977 and the mighty MBTM checklist.
That's a lot of comics.
It's a lot of comics.
For those keeping score at home, that's a lot.
To become a patron, just head to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth. But before we talk about the Marvel Comics of May 1977, we're going to start out, as we always do, with a quick journey into history and learn a little bit about what else was happening in May of 1977. Rob, kick us off, please.
On the 1st of May, May Day, if you will, 1977, in one of the largest mass arrests in U.S. history, 1,414 anti-nuclear activists were arrested at the Seabrook Station nuclear power plant near Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The prisoners were held in jails and in New Hampshire National Guard armories for up to 12 days until the remaining 550 demonstrators were released without posting bail because of the cost of their imprisonment.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm. Turns out it's hard to detain a lot of people and keep them alive and fed.
Yeah. Just worth keeping in mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If anybody's out there listening that might want to be into detaining a bunch of protesters, don't.
Please don't. On the 7th of May, MBTM insider Gorgeous Greggy Roland, that's seriously how he wants to be referred to, shares that this is the date of Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau spinning a controversial pirouette behind an oblivious Queen Elizabeth during a G7 summit conference in London.
What?
Years later, James Coutts, one of Trudeau's aides, noted that far from being spontaneous, the pirouette, like his many other attention-getting gestures, had been planned and even rehearsed by the Prime Minister. He planned it hours before because he strongly opposed the palace protocol that separated heads of state from heads of government. The well-rehearsed pirouette was a way of showing his objection without saying a word.
Pretty cool.
I don't want to stereotype Canada.
Okay,
but just gonna start with that. Their reputation as being nice and such, you know, like that. I don't love that. But having said that, a controversy sparked over a pirouette could not be more Canadian.
Yeah, sure.
That's like the nicest thing you could do.
Mm-hmm. I suspect because it's a French word and there's the whole like French Canada versus the rest of Canada.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, that was probably.
Think about that. Totally. Oui. On the 8th, the Grateful Dead recorded their live concert album Cornell 5877 during the rock group's performance at Barton Hall at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. The recording itself would not be released until 40 years later in 2017.
They probably got too high.
Forgot all about it.
Yeah, man.
On the 10th of May 1977, my dad turned 34.
Whoa.
And also, Ramses II returned to Egypt on an airplane flight from Paris, landing in Cairo after his 3,212-year-old mummy was cured by radiation of 60 types of fungi and 2 strains of insects.
Whoa.
Ramses had ruled Egypt from 1279 BC to 1235 BC, and his mummy had been in France for 8 months. And comics fans know Ramses II as...
Kang?
Not Ramatut. The mummy guy, right? The living mummy?
What's Ramses II's Greek name?
What is it?
I don't know.
It's the password for his computer.
Nope.
Night Owl and Rorschach.
Whoa.
Enter.
Wow.
To discover his plan.
Ozymandias.
Bing.
Nice.
That's it.
Yeah.
Whoa. King of Kings.
Yeah.
Cool.
There you go.
Wow. Well done.
I'll edit it and make you seem smarter.
Okay.
You came up with a
well,
lot.
Well, you're going to do a lot of editing, buddy. on the 12th of May, my wife and partner in life, Barbara Allen, turned 4 years old.
Whoa. Wow.
On the 17th of May, no coincidence, the first Chuck E. Cheese restaurant was opened as a venture by Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari Incorporated in San Jose, California.
God, the first Chuck E. Cheese must have been horrifying. Did they have animatronics?
Yeah, but I think they all worked then.
Oh, okay.
They were just even, like, clack, 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 clack.
Right. When I was a kid, we went to the Chuck E. Cheese that's not too far from here. That's closed now.
But, yeah.
And it was cool.
Yeah. I mean, have nothing but great memories of Chuck E. Cheese when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the pizza sucked and I got in trouble for throwing a piece at my brother who was in the ball pit. But, you know,
but that's not on them.
It's Chuck E. Cheese.
That's on you.
That's because I was raised wrong.
Oh, right, right. I keep forgetting. On the 25th, the film Star Wars premiered in 32 movie theaters across the United States before reaching other cinemas nationwide. Critics who had previewed the film gave it good reviews, with Time magazine dubbing it the year's best movie. Charles Champlin called it the year's most razzle-dazzling family movie, an exuberant and technically astonishing space adventure.
Technically astonishing.
Oh, yeah, right. Gene Siskel commented that Star Wars is not a great movie in the sense that it describes the human condition. It is simply a fun picture with a spectacular visual effects, the best since Stanley Kubrick's 2001.
That's accurate.
Some hated the film, with one calling it frequently boring with a fairy tale plot. Was that you? Did you say that?
No.
Relentlessly childish and no more sophisticated or believable than an old Spider-Man comic book. Hey,
come on.
It's at least
I take that very personally.
Yeah. It's as at least as believable as an old Spider-Man comic book. Star Wars would go on to break the record for highest grossing film, surpassing Jaws, The Godfather, and The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
Whoa.
The hills are dead.
Wow.
And finally, on the 26th of May, George Willig, who dubbed himself the human fly, but not the same human fly as either of Marvel's 1970s characters, set a record for highest climb up the side of a building by scaling Tower 2 of the World Trade Center, ascending 1,350 feet in 3 hours and 30 minutes. After reaching the roof, Willig stepped onto the top to accept congratulatory handshakes and signed autographs for a squad of admiring cops, who immediately took him into custody on an array of misdemeanor charges.
What? Why?
You can't go climbing that building.
You can't go climbing a
building? This was on the news when I was a kid. I remember this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Whoa. It was awesome.
Wow.
Like, it was a big deal.
Huh. This is our building. You can't climb
it. They were like, you. It's just too dangerous. Like all of the like insurance issues and.
Oh, because if he got hurt, they'd have to pay for it?
Presumably. Like if somebody twists their ankle on your, you know, walkway in front of your house, if you fall off 1,000 feet off of a building and die,
right?
It could be somebody.
But that's
fun. Free.
That's essentially
no harm, no foul.
Yeah. Yeah. After the city of New York initially threatened a $250,000 civil lawsuit, Mayor Abraham Beam settled its complaint with a fine of $1.10, representing a penny for each of the 110 floors climbed.
That's a cool ass mayor.
Yeah.
That's the kind of mayor we're going to be.
Yeah.
We're mayor?
Yeah, just singularly.
Oh,
we run. Okay. It's like a shared
triumvirate.
A unimind.
A unimind.
I want to be Beelzebub.
Next time.
Well, okay. We'll let you talk about what was going on in the comics industry if that's good enough.
Okay, that's good enough.
Okay.
$1.10, good enough. former and current Marvel bullpenners who celebrated birthdays this month included Stan Goldberg, who turned 45 on May 5th. Marvelous Marv Wolfman, who turned 31 on May 13th.
He's been around for a while.
Yeah. Right. He's been doing this as a kid.
Yeah.
Gardner Fox, who turned 66 on May 20th. Happy Herb Trimpe, who turned 38 on May 26th.
I would not have guessed that. I thought he was significantly older.
Well, it's 1977, 38.
Oh, okay. So he looks like
50.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Definitely over 50.
Yeah.
Best-selling American graphic novelist Raina Telgemeier was born in San Francisco on May 26th.
Whoa.
And on May 28th, the final Detroit Triple Fanfare, once the oldest regular comic book convention in the world, opened its doors in Detroit, Michigan.
Whoa. Detroit, Michigan.
Awesome.
Marvel published 51 comics, 4 magazines, and 1 Treasury edition in May of 1977. Our patrons are going to hear us talk about 31 of them in the extended version of this episode. New series debuting this month included Godzilla an in-continuity ongoing licensed series pitting the King of the Monsters against S.H.I.E.L.D.'s Dum Dum Duggan and the heroes of the Marvel Universe.
That definitely doesn't seem fair. I mean, you have to add the heroes in, otherwise that's a pretty short comic book.
Right. It's like the Bambi meets Godzilla.
right.
Short. Yeah. Yeah. Squish.
Also debuting was Human Fly, an ongoing series kind of sort of based on stunt performer Rick Rojat. Featuring a young stunt performer whose skeleton was replaced by steel following a near fatal car crash.
Oh.
So I assume that Wolverine just stole that idea.
Yep.
Wholesale.
Yeah. If you're, you know how bad that would hurt all the time? You know anybody who has like a
steel plate?
Who has a steel plate or screw that is constantly in pain when it gets cold? Mm. If your bones were steel, you'd just be like, kill me.
Right.
But you couldn't be
maybe killed. With each additional one, the pain doesn't go up proportionally. So it's like it only goes so far and then you're still like, well, this sucks, but it doesn't suck worse than.
I mean, Wolverine does seem angry all the time.
He does seem pretty crabby.
Yeah. So,
okay, we solved it.
He also smokes. So, you know.
Right. Marvel also canceled three series this month.
What?
This month, we're going to see the last issue of Inhumans.
No way.
Number 12.
Wow.
Marvel Premiere, also issue 12. And Iron Fist, issue 15.
I mean, I obviously know, but for those at home, would you clarify which one Marvel Premiere is? I obviously am super clear on what
one. Guardians
what?
Of the Galaxy.
Oh, no.
Yep.
Yeah. I like that one.
Yeah. They just started to work things out, so they cancel it.
Kill it.
That's the move.
Plug it. Yep. Oh, man.
That is what May 1977 looked like in the comics world and beyond. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll be talking about the Marvel comics of May 1977 with David Harper.
Yeah.
Right here on Marvel by the Month. Hey there. If this is your first episode of Marvel by the Month, thanks for stopping by. You are listening to the public version of this week's episode, which has been edited down for time constraints. But if you want the full May 1977 Marvel Comics experience, just head to patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and support us for $5 a month to get instant access to the extended version of this week's episode. That version features coverage of more of this month's Marvel comics, plus a more in-depth version of our conversation with David Harper.
Not to mention the other 180-plus extended and exclusive episodes in that Patreon-exclusive bonus feed. You get to hear longer conversations about more comics with some of our favorite guests, like Brian Michael Bendis, Kelly Sue DeConnick, Jerry Conway, Matt Fraction, Carla Pacheco, Howard Chaykin, Steve Englehart, Mike Allred, David F. Walker, and so many more.
And look, if you're not quite ready to join as a paid member, you can still go to patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and sign up as an absolutely free member to get our weekly newsletter. Free members can also buy individual episodes outright for a one-time cost. So if you want to try it before you buy it, that's a great way to do it.
Our patrons help us cover the costs of making this show every week, including helping us buy the time in our lives that it takes to do it.
We want to keep making this show for you week in and week out, and the best way to make sure that happens is if you're able to head to patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth and support us today. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month, everybody. You know, we spent a lot of time on this show talking about comics that hit the stands almost 50 years ago, but did you know they are still publishing new comics today?
What? Get out of town.
It's true. And this week's guest is one of the most trusted sources for what's worth checking out. He's the one-man media empire behind the comics journalism site Sketch.com and the off-panel podcast. David Harper, thanks for joining us on Marvel by the Month.
Yay!
Hey.
Thank you so much for having me. It is worth it for being described as a media empire. That is definitely a first for me.
Well, you certainly have earned it. So Sketch celebrated its 10th anniversary this year.
Yes. Yeah. Sketch and Off Panel actually celebrated the 10th anniversary. I will say it is really bad counting because there was like, I actually ran Sketch for a year and then I took like 3 years off and then I brought it back. But it's 10 calendar years since it started, I'm counting it.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. How did it get start? What was the original intention? And how has it kind of evolved over the last decade?
So I started, well, I have to go back even further.
Okay,
I started writing for Multiversity Comics back in 2009. The very abbreviated version of that was I was part of a pop punk music forums or kind of like pop punk, hardcore, slash emo, whatever, music forums, like, or music sites forum. And on that, there was a thread called Wednesday is New Comic Book Day. I would always talk about comics with people on there. This one person came on, was like, hey, I'm starting a comic site. Does anybody want to write for it? And I was like, sure. And so I started writing for them. And then somehow that weird Motley Crue that I was one of the first three people on, we ended up being nominated for an Eisner in 2014.
Cool.
And it was pretty cool. And then I decided I'd been doing previews, reviews, and news so much. I'd written something like 3,500 articles in 4.5 years.
Wow.
And I was like, I kind of want to write less, but also more simultaneously by writing only features. And so I left to do Sketched, and it was just my own thing. And that's where I started Off Panel, my weekly comics interview podcast. It's 500. I just finished editing episode 524 earlier today.
Amazing.
So,
gosh, wow.
Yeah, and so I've been doing that ever since. But yeah, I mean, the reason why I got into it is just because I love comics. The Sketch in specific is, you know, I really love sites like, I don't know if you're familiar with Grantland. It was a site that was spinoff of ESPN.
Yeah.
That was a site I really liked. I like the depth that they looked at subjects with, but also like the kind of silliness that they could do sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the blend that I want to bring, is just like, how can I bring my own voice to comics and do it in a way that is me without trying to be someone else? And like, when I brought it back in 2019, I brought it back as a subscription site. And I was like, I have no idea if anybody is actually going to pay me for this. And somehow now making Sketch and Off Panel is my full time job. So
yeah.
Who the hell knows?
What a dream.
You just set me up for the next thing. So you had a very eventful 2025 so far.
Yes.
Sketch turned 10. You had what the medical community would describe as a cardiac event.
Yes.
And then you got laid off from your day job of, was it 14 years? Something
yes.
like that. Wow.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And now you're doing the comics thing full time. How's it going, and what has surprised you about it so far?
Well, I will say, if I want to give you good news, so my cardiac event was actually a minor heart attack that led into pericarditis, which is a thing that I won't bore you with, but it's not good.
okay.
I will say that I got 100%. I'm looking good, and they expect me to be full recovery going forward. And I can even get back to exercising and taking less medication, which sounds amazing.
Good.
I will be on two pills for the rest of my life, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going great. I mean, honestly, like the whole thing, all of it. I mean, who expects a heart attack and who expects to get laid off? I certainly didn't. To the point where, here's if I can give you one bit of advice, if you ever start having chest pain, don't go to the gym and try to run it off, because that's what I did.
Oh, yeah, that doesn't sound
I ran
right.
4 miles while actively having a minor heart attack, which is the doctors were very surprised that I did not die from that.
Wow. If it was anyone else, I would say that's a real weird flex. But but because it's you, it's like, okay, he's not trying to stunt on us here. Yeah.
No. It was a very. My wife told me later, don't do that next time. I was like, well, how about we just not have a next time?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Sketching Off Panel. Like when I got focused on it, I was kind of amazed by how much the comics community came out to support me. I've shared this publicly, and like the amazing thing is in the first week after I revealed kind of what happened to me, Sketch subscribers grew by more than any other year besides the first year in terms of like paying subscribers.
Wow.
And
oh my gosh.
It was really kind of astounding. But like, as far as like, The funny thing is I've had a lot of questions like, how has it changed your process or what you do? And it just means that I have more time, and I also can actually have a life beyond, like, previously what I was doing is I was just doing it on the side of my day job. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot of writing at nights, a lot of writing on weekends. And now it's like, I get to spend time with my wife.
Hey.
And I get to spend time with my cats. And I've been to so many movies lately with my mom. It's amazing. She loves it. My mom is the big winner for my 2025.
That's terrific.
But yeah, it's going great.
Awesome.
You're making me see a dream beyond these evenings and weekends and whatever else we're doing with this thing. Yeah.
You need a few more side hustles.
Yeah. That's what we always say. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is terrible advice, and I shouldn't give it to anyone else, but like I truly can say that, like, I honestly think that getting laid off was probably one of the best things that could have happened to me. Because like, I already had something in place to kind of lean on. And then on top of that, it made a decision I was too afraid to make.
Right.
And like, it forced me to do something I really wanted to do. And it's been great. I've loved it. And I've definitely had to spend a lot less money, though. It turns out comics journalists and podcasters don't make that much money.
But, yeah. What? No way. Know,
that jet setting lifestyle has had to get scaled back somewhat.
Yeah, that's right.
I saw a meme recently. It's like, the economy is so bad, I guess I got no choice except to follow my dreams. Kind of, maybe we're all going to be there soon. So, David, a lot of what you do is documenting the present moment in the comics industry with an eye to the future. You've also, though, done some excellent long form historical pieces for Sketched. So, you know, you've got that history side of you as well. Do you prefer one over the other? Do they scratch different itches?
I actually really love doing oral histories and the retrospectives. So I did, just really quick for your listeners, I'll just list off some of them. I did one, an oral history for the 2015 Secret Wars. I did one for Annihilation, the event comic, the cosmic event. I did one for the DC Marvel crossover from 1995. And I've done a bunch of other different ones. Those are some of like the big Marvel ones. And I love doing those. The only problem is like the Secret Wars one took me like 4.5 months of like interviews. And like on top of that, I have a lot of like people will talk to me, which is great. But there's some ones where it's really difficult to get people to want to talk, you know, for a history piece. Like, I don't want to talk about it because it was the past. I don't want to do this for X, Y, or Z. And then some people are just kind of hard to reach. And so I would do more of those if it was like kind of sustainable for me to do it and also sustainable to like keep getting access to people. But so I kind of love them both. The main thing I like is I like variety. I like to scratch different itches and I like to like kind of go down different pieces. So the way I kind of look at it is I kind of try to trade off like the different sides of me. I have like the retailer side where I talk to comic shops about what they're doing and how they're doing, like what's selling, what's not selling, etc. I do the pieces that are kind of more like interview centric. Like I had a piece that went up today with artist Eric Zawadzki about Assorted Crisis Events, which is an image series. And I like digging into the art form and everything like that. So it's really just about finding a balance. I don't like one more than the other, but it's just what is scratching an itch for me right now.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
I've got one.
Oh, go for it.
Totally off the cuff. What's the sort of oldest, since we're, you know, we've started in the 60s and we're in the 70s, what's the sort of most storied creator that you've talked to from Marvel or DC?
I mean, storied is it's a very relative opinion. And I will say that, like, that's one group that I would really love to feature more because I've not had a lot of success talking with creators from probably like the 70s era is definitely not like something I've covered a lot. I will say the one that I'm happiest that I have that I managed to make happen was Keith Giffen. Getting to talk to Keith Giffen for that Annihilation feature and then just, I don't know. I mean, he was a great guy. And like when he passed away, that really hit me hard. Yeah. And it just, I remember talking to another comics journalist about that and about how like we need to do a better job of like highlighting the legends and, you know, before you can't tell their story, because I think that comics has a bad history of kind of discarding people once they've, you know, reached a certain age. And like, that's really unfair because there's so many great people that have done remarkable work. And yeah, I mean, there's a huge list of people that I would love to talk to and that I've tried to talk to. So hopefully in the future that my list for you will be much longer.
Well, that's great. I mean, Keith Giffen is solid, and that's, we're getting to see a lot of his early Marvel work right now.
He just hit where we're at. Yeah. And you had a great interview with Klaus Janson too, not that long ago.
I think Jim Starlin was this year too. And it was great talking with Jim and everything.
Yep.
And I'm glad I got to talk to Peter David before he passed away.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like for that DC versus Marvel thing. And like, there's a lot of people that like, if I had a comics journalism time machine where I could go back and talk to people, like I would love to talk to Mark Gruenwald. Like Mark Gruenwald is just like a person that I just think that he seemed like such a good dude. And I, you know, it's, he died so young, and it's just such a shame. But yeah, the history is of comics is filled with some pretty amazing people.
Oh, absolutely. Agreed. Yeah, yeah, for sure. So leading into what we're here to talk about today, how much time have you spent with 1970s Marvel, either as a historian or a comics reader?
It's very generous that you call me a historian. so here's the funny thing. I was telling my wife about this morning. When I grew up, some of the first comics I read were from the 60s. Like, mm-hmm. I had, like, The Origins of the Marvel Universe by Stan Lee. Yeah, you know, that graphic novel with the trade paperback with collecting a bunch of comics from that period. It only took me, 20 years to realize that it being called by Stan Lee was a little So I'm very familiar with the 60s. I'm very familiar with the 80s. I'm very familiar with the 90s, 2000s. You're getting where I'm going.
Oh, yeah.
The 70s are kind of an odd period for me where there's, like, a lot of stuff that I either haven't read or I read, and I was like, I kind of wish I liked the Kree Skrull War more.
Yeah.
That's kind of the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Well, it was funny, like, going into it, I think a lot of us are I would say a lot of the stuff that we have covered, this is our first time through most of it, like the vast majority.
Oh, yeah. Similarly, I started reading comics in the late 70s as a young kid. And so through the 80s and 90s, my dad and my brother and I all collected. So that's all pretty familiar to me. But the 70s and then, of course, the 60s was where it started, at least for Marvel.
Yep.
And the 70s was a weird blank. And I've maybe read 3 Tomb of Dracula comics before we were doing them on this podcast, and just similarly, it's mm-hmm. and we were dreading it when we were dreading the 70s when we started this podcast, because Kirby was going to be, I mean, first Kirby was gone and now Kirby's back, but it just seemed like it was going to be a terrible fallow period. And then we got here and there's Starlin and there's Giffen and
there's some very good stuff.
Walt Simonson
very
starting.
Weird stuff. and there's some really good stuff that we're coming up on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I have read the X-Men stuff because like my one collection that I have that I'm trying to like do a complete run of is the first volume of X-Men/Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah.
And so I've read like all the Claremont, Byrne, Cockrum stuff and everything like that. But it is kind of funny how that the 60s, it's like it's unignorable because it is the foundation of everything. It's where it started. You kind of had to go through it. And there's so much great stuff there. And then like the 80s, it's just like it's wall to wall with amazing comics.
Right.
And everyone
right.
is like, this is iconic. What are you going to do? Not read Frank Miller's Daredevil?
Right.
but then the 70s, there's so many good things in there, too. But it's all like there's a lot of odd stuff in there. I'm a big basketball fan, and it kind of reminds me of, it's just like the 70s was a time of a lot of drugs, and that makes things a little weird.
You are definitely seeing a fair amount of that. Maybe some of it in at least one of the comics that we're going to talk about today.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Oh, yeah.
Can I interview the interviewers?
Ooh, no, please.
Yeah. How do you feel about the 70s now that you've gotten into it?
There's a lot of stuff that is very forgettable. It is just they had to fill their 17 to 20 pages that month in that issue, and they did it, and it is technically a comic book, and it was released on time. It was released on time. But then you've also got stuff like some really crazy awesome stuff like Starlin's Warlock, like just about everything Steve Englehart did, like his run on Captain America is amazing. There's periods where the Avengers get really good, and now they're in a very good period.
Yeah, and all the stuff with Man-Thing, with Howard the Duck, even.
Steve Gerber is an acquired taste, but once you acquire it.
And Tomb of Dracula, like Gene Colan doing that comic, it's been my favorite thing. It's the thing that keeps me, I'm excited every week when I'm getting to Tomb
of
Dracula.
It's at the tail end of the alphabet, too, which is nice.
I did not expect
that.
Both of us. I don't think any of us thought that. I didn't give Tomb of Dracula a second thought for all of my life, probably, until we started reading it for this.
The best stuff that Marvel is doing, I mean, the worst stuff that Marvel is doing is a lot of their flagship heroes, like the big stars of the 60s, like, a lot of that stuff is very, very mediocre for long stretches, but it's the stuff around the edges. Like the Luke Cage Power Man stuff is great. Like it's good more often than it's not.
Right. Yeah.
I
often find that some of my favorite stuff is the things that are on like the periphery when it comes to the big two.
Yeah.
Like I have a mailbag that goes up tomorrow where I answer like subscriber and patron questions about like whatever people want to ask. And somebody asked me a very open to interpretation question, which was basically, what is your favorite stupid best comic? And I interpreted it in two ways. Like the way that they phrased it, it was almost like it could mean like a comic that you're higher on than the consensus that you think is an all time great. Mm. Or there's a comic that's just kind of stupid that you really love.
Mm-hmm.
And there was three comics that I picked from there. There were all big two books. Well, actually, two of them were big two. One was Valiant. One was Tom Payer and Rags Morales's Our Man. I don't know if anybody ever read that. It was a DC book from the early 2000s about the Android version of Our Man.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Huh. That's not stupid. What is dumb, but it is very smart in its stupidity, is John Arcudi and Doug Mankey's Major Bummer. Hmm. I don't know. Do you anybody know what that book is? It's about two aliens who I think are like basically college students who want to experiment with what would happen to a human if you gave them like basically like ultimate superpowers. And instead of going to Martin Lewis, who is like an upstanding individual who like deserves great powers because he has great responsibility, they give it to Lou Martin, a guy who's like 18 and is a complete slacker. And John Arcudi once described it as like, he has the ability to cure cancer, but that takes work. So he just decides to use his powers to steal cable. And it is like kind of a send up of like 90s comics and stuff. No one read it. I rep for it. It's like 15 issues. Peter Tomasi was the editor of it.
Wow.
It's fantastic. And like, I like, it's comics like that, like the Tomb of Dracula for you guys, where it's like, did you expect to read a comic about a slacker or the Tomb of Dracula and it's really going to be amazing for you? Right. No, but sometimes that's where the magic happens with big two stuff.
Yeah,
definitely. I mean, I'm a massive Alpha Flight fan, so yeah. There's anything that is the underdog. Whenever we hit Stingray, when he first appeared, I'm like super excited. Sure. So, you know, Stiltman also, we celebrated every time he shows up. So we get that sort of weird fringe character and book love.
My kind of takeaway is that like it's not, you think of the 70s Marvel as sort of like a homogenous blob of, you know, however you attribute that 70s blob, but like it's not like that. There's just there's all this variety at every month, and we're seeing it in the weirdest places.
Even in the three books we're going to talk about today.
Maybe there you go.
Stay tuned.
We did our best to pick three definitive mid-1977 Marvel comics to talk about, because we want to give you the absolute late 70s Marvel experience. So Jamie's going to kick this off with Iron Fist number 14.
Right on. This is called Snowfire, written by Chris Claremont, art by John Byrne with Dan Green, letters by Annette Kowecki, colors by Janice Cohen, and edited by Archie Goodwin. So for reasons that are not immediately clear, Iron Fist is in the Canadian Rockies, supporting an injured Colleen as they limp and eventually fall down through the snow. They fall because a full body shooter named Joe has dropped them both with a single burst. His boss wants to at first inspect the bodies, and we see Iron Fist's eyes open, so we're thinking he's not dead. And then the group of baddies say that, like, well, a night in the Arctic blizzard is going to kill you just the same. We don't need to investigate any further. Then once they zip off, Iron Fist carries Colleen through the snow to an old abandoned weather shack. And at this point, we flash back to a day earlier in New York City, which made me feel good because I was like, oh, I didn't read the wrong comic. We weren't supposed to know what was happening.
And that happens sometimes.
Claremont's good for that. Did I miss an issue?
Yeah.
No, we'll get filled in.
Right. Yep. You know, because like occasionally we will read the wrong issue and like, there's no way to tell that that's happened.
Yeah. And of course, this series is also it's the debut of Claremont and Byrne working together as a team. So that is always fun to see.
Yeah. And Dan Green inking Byrne is pristine. This just looks
pretty good. Yeah.
The colors popped. Like I thought my iPad had updated its operating system. I was like, why does this look so like fresh? Okay. So. Back in New York City, Iron Fist had been fighting with a mysterious figure who was dressed kind of like him. He knew that his name was Danny. He knew about Kunlun, and he was also able to like leech Iron Fist's energy away by just rubbing their bellies together.
You give them like a dragon hug.
They just kind of do this cute little wiggle, and Iron Fist's energy is drained. Very mysterious. Back in the shack, in the present, Dany and Colleen do a Zen trance to stay warm. And she can only do this because of their recent mind meld, which was a thing that Colleen had considered a violation when it first happened.
Which I think is fair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think if somebody even used the force on me briefly, I would be like, put that person in jail.
Yeah. Right. I like that plot point has been continuing to come up. And it just feels like very Claremont-y that like something has happened to a character and it matters.
Mm-hmm.
It's also mentioned like 5 times in the issue. So there's a lot of constant reminders in the issue itself.
Yep. Which is like definitely Claremont-y. But I guess like you sort of prefer that direction than the opposite, where you're like, none of this matters and it is very disposable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just kind of a different feel. So then now we're flashing back. So the structure here is like we're bouncing back and forth a bunch. Half a day ago, Dany arrived in Calgary on a plane where he met Colleen. And Colleen had been working as a bodyguard for Jaren Hogarth, or Trinity from the Matrix, for those who only know Iron Fist from the hit Netflix television show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Yeah.
I totally forgot that they gender swapped.
Yeah.
Carrie Ann Moss's
character. Yeah. That was the first, my first exposure to Jaren. Mm-hmm. So I like, it just feels wrong every single time.
Right.
Oh, you're going to do the whole, they can't switch that.
Yeah. No, right. Right.
Okay.
But backwards.
Oh
yeah,
boy.
Right.
Yeah. I'm the only person who sort of liked the Iron Fist Netflix show. Yeah.
I watched it. Someone described it as what if Donald Trump Jr. got super martial arts powers?
Oh, yeah. I could see that. I could kind of see a little bit of that.
I feel like that's unfair to Dany Rand.
That is very unfair to Dany Rand.
I mean, it's really giving
and the show.
Don Jr. way too much
way
credit.
Way too much credit. Yeah, more like that.
That show, the problem was, is like Dany Rand was the least interesting part of the entire thing.
The Meachums were amazing.
Yeah, the good news is it's not the case in this comic, but that was definitely the case in that show.
Yes.
Agreed.
So Colleen has called Dany here to serve as backup since Misty Knight is already on a mission in the Caribbean. I think there might be a footnote saying, like, we'll talk more about that soon, because I didn't know anything about that and wasn't sure if I, again, had, like, missed an issue or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, Claremont, not only leaves a plot thread dangling, at this point, he's also introducing plots without telling you about them.
Right. So you're like constantly off balance.
Yep.
And then on mentioning her name, Colleen asked Dany if he realizes how badly he's hurt her recently. Dany shares that he's aware. He feels bad about it. He's never felt this way before, partially because everyone he has ever known famously has died horribly. So
or is a super ninja.
Right.
Yeah.
So then they go from the airport to a car to a helicopter. And then they get off it and Sabretooth is there.
What?
And he's tied up this Hogarth fellow. And as weird as this is to say, this is the first appearance of Sabretooth.
Yeah.
Very strange introduction. Graphic designer Rob, tell us what we won.
Well, this is the classic Sabretooth. He's got a orange and black outfit that has
like a tiger.
But not in a stripey way.
No, yeah. And he's got the really furry like armbands.
So much fur.
Yeah, from his knees down, it's like he's wearing the infinite Uggs. But yeah, it's a he also like, and from his sort almost a deep V, like the mid chest, we have the big sort of fur going around the side. So he looks like if Kraven was classy. I mean, not that
it looks comfortable. I'm not gonna lie. Absolutely. I would wear it.
Oh, definitely going to keep him warm.
In Alaska, it would be great.
Yeah, totally. Well, especially after, how many pages have we seen of Dany Rand in this issue, like running around in a skin-tight outfit with no shoes in like foot-high or foot-deep snow? Like,
yeah, but he does have, there's no mask. It's just Sabretooth with a, fairly short hair for him.
Mm-hmm. Kind of luscious, luscious texture,
big
though.
Old sideburns, chops, and... just crazy eyebrows. Yep. This guy has got eyebrows for days.
His fingers seem pointy.
Yes, they do.
A claw type way. His teeth may or may not be pointy from this first page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they look a little pointy. He's got a little pointy grin.
Yeah. So we learned that he's a freebooter. We all know what that is, right?
Somebody sleeps on my couch.
I looked at it. But it's a modern day pirate who, for the right price, will rip off anybody. Rip, because he's a saber tooth.
Oh,
he's,
I get it.
We'll see what they're doing there.
Yep.
So he's been hired to take Hogarth because Hogarth had been nosing around in the wrong thing. We don't know specifically what quite yet. And he declares that the plan is for them to leave first thing in the morning with Hogarth and now Colleen and Iron Fist, who are all prisoners. Iron Fist and Colleen use their sort of spiritual connection, or psychic rapport, you could say. to time their battle to escape. So they like shake off the guards and then they run off into the snowy night. Day and night are not super well defined with the lighting and background and such. That part's a little vague. The next morning, they knock out some baddies in the snow and steal their clothing right away.
So now we're caught up to where we started all these.
They've
flashbacks.
Left the shack in the snowstorm.
We're tearing.
Can I ask a quick question about this page?
Go for it.
Where did the sleeping bags come from? The very warm seeming sleeping bags. Who had those on them? Because if Danny Rand and Colleen Wing were not using them before,
no.
Were these people just packing wearable sleeping bags with them? I'm very curious about this part of it.
I think they were on their snow
machine.
The snow machines. I think because they said their sleeping bags will keep them warm until then.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Yeah.
I guess.
I mean, I guess if you're going to go out into the tundra-esque with a snowmobile, you might pack that.
And we don't know how erratic a boss Sabretooth is at this point. He seems like kind of a respectable business guy, so he's pack appropriately and he prints them out a list and he's like, these are the things you're gonna need for this
mission. It's all OSHA compliant.
So they knock out these guards, I guess, steal their clothing, wrap them in sleeping bags, but Colleen very clairvoyantly describes as a second skin that feels marvelously warm. You just get those weird little Claremont, is this sexy? What are you, doing here?
This up?
Yeah. Second skin makes me feel uncomfortable. All right. So they knock out the guards. Collins explains that somebody has been leeching money off the Rand Meacham Corporation. And this is Danny Rand and Meachams, who are the other characters. And that Hogarth was their lawyer, was looking into who was responsible for this leeching. So then they make it back to Sabretooth's plane with a plan for Colleen. So Colleen, her job is to free Hogarth or free Hogarth's staff.
Right.
Get weapons, take care of the rest of the mercenaries. And then Danny Rand's Iron Fist job is to fight Sabretooth. So they would clear division of labor.
Great. It's partnership.
Yeah. They don't exactly know how powerful Sabretooth is at this point, other than one smack maybe. So it seems like they might have done a little different division of labor, but that's what they did.
Yeah, that's not really a 50-50 split as far as. Sabretooth has been busy threatening Hogarth with death and also uses the word bub. So we got our first Sabretooth Wolverine.
Yeah, his speech patterns are very Wolverine-y.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Colleen's kind of sneaking in full disguise. Sabretooth's instincts tell him that one of the guards aren't who they seem to be. But before he can do anything about it, Iron Fist appears behind Sabretooth, dressed as the guard. And then Sabretooth rips the costume open, revealing the Iron Fist costume underneath. And the two begin to fight for quite some time.
I love that he just takes the first level of costume off. It's great.
It's an accurate slice.
Yeah, very, very precise.
Iron Fist mentally remarks on the speed and razor-sharp claws, describing as the ultimate killing machine. Which, we know who Sabretooth is because we've been exposed to him 10 billion times. But if you're reading this for the first time, you're like, who's the guy with the weird fur on his collar?
Does he
always wear that, or is he just cold because we're in a cold mission?
He's a human saber-tooth tiger.
Mm-hmm. Without the saber teeth.
Or stripes.
He's got pointy teeth.
It would be great if Byrne decided in his first appearance just to give him two gigantic fangs that go down to his chest.
Just drool everywhere.
Yeah. He talks like this the entire time.
Classic saber-tooth stuff. So then off camera, Colleen has done everything on her to-do list. And then after securing Hogarth, Iron Fist goes after Sabretooth, who's kind of run off. Sabretooth was making his escape into the snowy landscape. Iron Fist follows and is immediately snowblinded from the light bouncing off the snow.
Sunrise, yeah.
Yep.
Sabretooth timed it. He knows what he's doing.
He sure does. This gives Sabretooth the upper hand. I don't know why Sabretooth wasn't blinded by the light.
Because he knew it was coming.
Yeah, so he looked in a slightly different direction.
I think. Exactly.
He's got the wits of a Sabretooth, you see.
That's right.
So then Iron Fist kind of continues to lose. Like, he loses this fight for kind of a bit because he can't see anything.
Also, he seems to be depowered.
Oh, yeah. He tries to charge his hand, but it doesn't. It's like more difficult than usual.
Yeah, that weird hug back in New York really took something out of him.
I guess
yeah.
so.
Yeah, he's still recovering.
I actually didn't connect that at the time, that yeah. those two events were related.
Yeah, his hand can no longer become a thing like unto iron.
Yes, right. We don't even get the quote, right?
No. Yeah.
So then he flashes back to some sort of like Luke Skywalker-esque training lesson where he's learning to use all his senses while fighting, wearing a blindfold. And then, so as I feel like it, does it intercut back and forth in like kind of a cool way?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're seeing past and present. He's starting to win the fight now. And at this point, the speech bubbles turn pink, which I was briefly confused about, but then realized it's because it's a snowy background.
Yeah.
When you have a white background, you don't want white bubbles.
Yeah, because you'd be blinded.
Exactly. You don't want to blind your reader.
Blind.
The Iron Fist kind of knocks out Sabretooth. He's kind of standing over his body, feeling pretty proud, it seems like. And then almost kicks Colleen. And manages to avoid doing that. And then notes shirtlessly how lucky it is that he happens to know martial arts. And then Colleen tells him that he should go inside because it's cold.
And
I do want to yeah. say, though, in these two pages of fight, there's all kinds of thought bubbles.
Yeah.
But the only yes. thing that Danny says out loud is missed. And then
Kyai,
right. as he kicks him.
Yep.
Like in two pages, those are the only things he says out loud in this fight. And yeah. I kind of like that.
Me too.
Yeah.
And it does go to differentiate him a bit from everybody else.
He's not a quipping. Daredevil, yeah. Spider-Man, quipping. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, and he's not like an anti-hero, like, I'm going to, you know.
Going to break everything and everywhere.
Right, right. Yeah. You're tangled with the wrong martial arts guy.
Yeah.
I don't write comics.
Yeah. Or act. Yeah. Neither of us. Right, just right. in case somebody confused us for right, a professional. Right.
Yeah, I did sort of speed through the fight scenes. I think they're particularly compelling looking.
I mean, you can see why John Byrne was getting everyone super excited about everything he was doing at this point.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Even from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great looking comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like clean where it needs to be clean, and there's detail where you need detail to be. Yeah. It was like a great issue of Iron Fist.
Yeah. And I'm sure like I had somewhere lodged in my brain a little bit of trivia that Sabretooth started out as an Iron Fist villain, but like I was still surprised when I was putting together the list of stuff we're going to read. It's like, wait, this is where Sabretooth
yeah,
shows up?
Like, yeah, I like never quite believed it. It was like very strange yeah. to see.
I feel like calling him a Sabretooth or a Iron Fist villain is very generous, though, because
right.
I'm pretty sure this is like the only time this actually happens.
Oh, right. Yeah, they
he's
don't become
ex-adjacent from here on. He's in Canada. Like, you know, yeah. we've already got the
right.
ties.
Yeah,
I think as soon as he said bub one time, they're like, wait a second,
hold
what
on
can we do
minute.
With this?
Yeah, and it says at the very end of this issue that the next issue, it's Iron Fist versus the X-Men. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it's Claremont. Everything he's writing at this point all winds up in the X-Men ultimately. So mm-hmm. it makes sense.
I do like that he also seems to be using Colleen to poke at Iron Fist in a way that is pretty satisfying. Like, she's like, yo, you know, you hurt that guy's feelings or that girl's feelings. And also stop standing out here in the cold. Like it is cool that he can be criticized in a comic. We're not seeing yeah. that in a lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
Where, like the hero is mocked,
yeah.
you know, playfully
deflated.
Oh, deflated.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. What did you think, David?
I thought it was great. I honestly, the part about it that really stands out the most to me is the Byrne art. John Byrne, for whatever the hell he is these days, there is just, I mean, the guy's got talent, and like even from the beginning it was obvious, and it progresses from there. But like the first appearance of Sabretooth, it's super random that it's an Iron Fist, but like the first time you see him, you're just like, this is a great looking character. It's not even my favorite Sabretooth design, but right from the top you're just like, there's something about this guy.
Yeah,
like
right.
this is a character that's gonna last. And like he does that throughout. I mean, like everything that Byrne does in this book is just like the best possible version of that.
Yeah.
And like it's hard not to love that. I will say there's one little bit in here that I get really locked in and really stupid minutia. And there is this part where, you know, he gets the chest part torn off of him when he's in the middle of the fight and everything. And then it skips a page, and then Colleen is like fighting with everybody, and there's glass that shoots out. Iron Fist jumps at Jaren Hogarth to try to save him, and he's wearing his blue pants. And then two panels later, he's wearing his green pants. So at what point in those two panels did he stop to take his extra pair of pants off? I need answers, John Byrne. Yeah. Where are we at here?
That kind of continuity issues would drive you mad in these comics. Where that isn't... I mean, this is something with attention to detail. There are many issues a month that are just like,
oh yeah,
all over the place.
No one cares.
Well, I mean, half the line is being edited by the same people who are writing the issues. So this is an exception to that. But
it turns out
a little sloppy.
You shouldn't edit your own writing.
Go figure.
I do think that there's like a fascinating interplay between Claremont and Byrne that's always been there, but it's just like you're talking about somebody who does like incredible storytelling visually, and then the person who is like, what is the most number of words I can put on?
How do I bury your work?
Yeah, how can I cover all these pictures up?
I like Claremont a lot. This is not me defaming him, is just like there's always been that element to it. Like during the fight, and there's like so many thought bubbles. I'm like, this is like an episode of Demon Slayer, but only in like text form on the page. Yeah, it's very wild.
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, you think it's like, wow, like Claremont and Byrne did so much great stuff together. Why did they stop doing it? And then you read anything that they did together, you're like, oh, I absolutely understand why they stopped working together. Like,
yeah.
It must have been very frustrating for both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To have somebody put that many words over your art,
like
that
painfully
is
rendered.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you eventually get to a point where Byrne is just like ignoring what Claremont has in the script and doing his own thing. And I'm sure that didn't go over well.
And I think the difference is like Claremont is like Don McGregor in that he puts a lot of words on the page, a lot of words, but they're doing something more than just like the old, the initial Stan Lee era, which was all just, here's 1,000 words to describe this picture that is worth 1,000 words.
It's right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it definitely works, and it takes you inside the character. Although sometimes there is like in the knockout panel where Danny takes out Sabretooth, there's three thought bubbles and like two like speech or word balloons where Danny does all of that in one punch.
And yeah, like, there's timing. Like,
there is like a little density in there where I'm just like, this is kind of wild stuff. But at the same time, like this is, I mean, honestly, reading this makes me want to read more of this Iron Fist run. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much of this is Claremont and Byrne, because you said it was the first issue that they did together.
It's not the first one, but it's one of the early ones.
Yeah, they've done about six maybe issues together. And yeah, it's just
really solid.
And it's really the high point of the series, easily. And there's only one more issue after this. Issue 15 winds up being the last of the series.
Oh, no way, really?
Yes.
Once it gets like the that's 70s Marvel too. Gosh. It starts to get good. Time to cancel
that thing. Yeah.
quick, kill it.
Yeah,
oh, man. I kind of felt like I knew it was probably coming to an end, because when it says in 60 days, enter the X-Men, when everything else was pretty much monthly, you're like, no.
Yeah. But I mean, then he quickly comes back, is Power Man and Iron Fist. So,
That's such a great idea, given how those two titles are. Like, that's just so clever.
It really works.
Looking forward to that.
Talk about Howard the Duck, number 15.
Oh, I gotta say, I can't believe you're not saving that one for last. That one is it's hard to come back from that one.
But this is I will start by saying this is one of the more linear stories of a Howard the Duck comic we've read in the last 6 months of Howard the Duck.
Yeah, I would say like the last 3 or 4 issues have felt very free jazz. Whereas this actually has a beginning, middle, and an end to it, which is kind of interesting. Yeah,
It has so much middle, it is unbelievable.
Boy, that middle!
The density of this is just wild.
Yep. Yeah.
So I'm going to stay pretty much describing the events that transpire, but, okay. but please jump in with any quotes or, you know, interesting anecdotes as you, as I move along.
Here. Yeah.
Okay. So the, this issue is titled The Island of Dr. Bong.
Mm, that's right. That makes you think, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really a think piece.
So I don't know if you guys know this, but Bong can have two different meanings.
Ooh, yeah, do go on.
Yeah, yeah, both the sound of a bell and a different thing that I'll explain to you when you're a little older.
The sound of a bell, you say? Yeah. I've never heard of that bong. Yeah, okay. I've cleaned dad's bong since I was a kid. This one's written by Steve Gerber, art by Gene Colan with Klaus Janson, letters by Irv Watanabe, colors by Klaus Janson. So it looks great. We begin with Bev and Howard walking on the deck of a cruise ship. Bev is in a bikini and seems to be causing a stir among the other passengers on deck, who are, I think, with one exception, men.
Yeah.
Howard is in a Hugh Hefner style captain's hat, smoking jacket, and ascot.
Yeah, the ascot's what did it for me.
Yeah,
yeah.
Is this definitely Gene Colan? This page?
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
It looks so different to me.
I think it's Klaus inking him.
Yeah, he's inking it and coloring it too. Yeah, so, yeah.
It's just so specific. Like,
it's not as drifty.
Nothing as abstract and
It's
woozy.
Not as misty as usual.
Right.
Yeah.
So apparently. This was news to me, but they're on their way back to the States from an adventure in the Middle East that happened in the Howard the Duck Annual Number 1, which is, comes out next month.
Which has not been published
yet. Yeah.
Yes. Cool. 1970s Marvel.
Nice work. Nice work.
They're talking about the events of whatever helping this caliph or something. And
oh, wait, you say Steve Gerber wrote and edited this?
Yeah. Bev points out that they should avoid the whispers of the rest of the guests and seek calm in the open sea, and goes on to describe like being called thunder thighs in high school and other stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. Howard remarks that he can use that calm as he is barely back in charge of his mental faculties after the recent events with him in an asylum.
Mm-hmm.
Howard muses about how the cruise ship is a monument to the free enterprise system, complete with pharmacies, boutiques, and theaters. But then he stops as these thoughts might lead him back toward madness.
Right.
Normal Gerber stuff.
Yeah. Also, it may be worth pointing out on the first panel of the second page, Beverly comes out and says that she says, actually, I suppose we're an item, but what of it? Where they try to play that really coy throughout this entire series. But now this is like the first time that it's like, yeah, they're boyfriend and girlfriend.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they establish it in the annual that hasn't come out yet.
Exactly. Sure. Yes. Yeah.
They consummate.
Yeah. It's very graphic.
Wow. The code approved this, huh?
It's a duck. What are we going to do?
It's like a nature film.
So Howard is settling into a state of calm as they look at the sea, he is hit in the back of the head with a shuffleboard puck. And it knocks him overboard. Beverly rushes to get help. And as mentioned before in this title, Howard, ironically, can't swim.
Yes.
It turns out that Winda is the one who hit the puck so terribly that it hit him. And she gets ready to throw a preserver to the head-injured duck. But before she does...
and
I'm sure at home you see this coming.
It's pretty predictable.
I just want to say, before we get into whatever is coming next,
yes.
I just want to point out that Winda doesn't just like toss it down there. She like full strength just hucks that thing.
Yeah. Yes.
Like it would hurt.
Oh, yeah. She's trying to take him out.
Yeah. And of course, she's holding this above her head. And then we cut to the page turn of, as you all know and expect, a giant sea serpent wearing a top hat.
Like Fred Astaire.
Clarifying.
Rises up out of the water and starts coiling around this enormous boat. So this is like...
It's huge.
Yeah. Kaiju.
This is a sea serpent with breeding.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. And it's saying knees.
Yeah.
With a Z.
Yep.
N-E-E-Z. Yep. Or lots of E's is in a Z.
Is this also where we first learn that the name of the ship is the SS Damned?
Yes.
Gerber.
And Winda, who, as you mentioned, David, Winda throws the preserver with all of her might, which, of course, hits Howard right in his already sore and lumpy head. crew members are...
shooting at the serpent to no avail. Howard then drifts near the body of the serpent and again just sees a sign like a placard on it that says, "To give serpent pleasure, press here," and there's a button. So Howard thinks, you know, what do I have to lose? And he presses the button. The serpent smiles with delight, quivers, and immediately leaves the ship alone, swimming off as it makes a sound that reads knees over and over again.
I want to know what Gene Colan was thinking when he was tasked with drawing this, because
his response to all of this must just be like, this fucking guy, like every time,
you want me to draw what?
Yeah. Okay.
And he does. It's so funny that like the main bulk of Gene Colan's work right now is Tomb of Dracula and this. He's done Doctor Strange and other things.
But
are there no pleasure buttons in Tomb of Dracula?
No, not, weirdly not.
Not labeled.
Yeah.
I feel like every issue of Howard the Duck is sort of like, wow, I can't believe the Comics Code approved this. Mm-hmm. And so far, we're like, what, five, six pages into this thing? And there's already been at least a couple of things. It's like, I'm shocked that this is making it through the 1977 censors.
Yeah, and it's like with Gene Colan, Gerber, the meaning is always like it's one of two things. One is like college dorm room, like, oh, wouldn't it be crazy, man, if it was all like we just had a different system, you know? And then but then the other is this, where it's like, what are you saying? Like, I know you're saying something very specific to you. I couldn't tell you what it is.
Yeah, there's so
or
much.
Or if it's just like the same college dorm room, it's like, what if it was like a sea serpent that was wearing a top hat like Fred Astaire?
Right, let's do it.
Right, but it had a pleasure button. You know, because we all have pleasure buttons. You know,
if you think about it.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
It's just it's commerce, you know? Like, what? What's happening?
Yeah, I think of Gerber writing as how John Lennon often wrote lyrics, where he's like, just pointedly obtuse, like he's just saying weird things, putting weird words together to see what that evokes, and then moving on with his life, and everyone else is like, what does it mean? I am the walrus mean,
right yeah.
Howard is of course thrown a rope, drawn back up to the deck. Howard's group, including Bev, Winda, and Paul, they did mention in an aside that Paul's with them.
Who is Paul again? I don't remember him.
He's the somnambulist. He's a sleepwalking guy who is he's a sleepwalking crime fighter who's an artist by day.
Okay. He wasn't in the asylum.
No.
No. Okay.
No. He just apparently went on this thing we're going to find out about next month.
Okay. I look forward
to that. It's all explained in this annual, folks. It'll all add up. I promise.
It's a load-bearing annual right there.
Yes, seriously. So they're all invited to a dining / party with the captain later that evening. So they arrive dressed for a full cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
Can I bring up a line really quick?
Yeah.
The previous page where Howard says that he's safe and sound except for the tarantulas dancing the polka in my stomach. That is got to be one of the most descriptive. Like my stomach is upset. Tarantulas dancing the polka in my stomach. I mean, what? It's magical.
Well, yeah. What Mad Lib was he filling in?
Yeah, that's what all of Mad Libs also. It feels like there's like post-it notes that you just shake in a hat and then put them together to make a plot and things that Howard thinks are.
It's very Naked Lunch.
Yeah. So of course Howard also is dressed in a suit, and he makes a remark about being a duck dressed as a penguin. And then a jazz trio of piano, bass, and drums rips into a cover of Kiss's "Rock and Roll All Night." So this is the second. I mean, this is the third book, I guess. with a Kiss reference or Kiss appearing in Howard the Duck.
Because I think it's next month that the Marvel Super Special featuring Kiss comes out.
Yeah.
And Gerber's writing that right now.
Their blood has already been drawn for the ink.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So
then the dinner arrives, and the already traumatized Howard, who has these tarantulas doing the polka in his stomach, is even more traumatized to see that the main course is duck l'orange. So there's just a full duck on the platter as they pull it off. And he is mortified, of course, and thinks some things about cannibalism and whatever else, and runs off to lose his cookies over the rail on the deck.
I gotta say, this could have been played as a gag, but this does come off as like
deeply upsetting to him.
Very upsetting.
Yeah.
It's also, like, I feel like he was targeted because that person came up and delivered it like right in front of him. I'm like, come on, you know he's a duck.
You know he's a duck.
Yeah.
If he's not a duck, he's a guy who wears a duck costume. So he obviously feels an affinity to ducks.
Yeah.
Which,
that's right.
Yeah. So as Howard is recovering in a deck chair after losing his cookies, a giant meteorite the size of a small car slams into the deck near him or right on him. It's hard to say in that first shot. Guests and crew arrive on the deck from the party to see Howard crawling over the boulder as they all realize that many more are falling from the sky.
And that full page splash of all the meteors falling from the sky is...
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty apocalyptic.
Yeah. It's this thing. It just feel like...
It's haunting.
Yeah.
We're just veering between... like a cannibalistic duck gag to an apocalyptic meteor storm on this boat. So it's just, yeah.
You know, for kids. Kids love this stuff. Can't get enough of it. Little cartoon duck. It's hilarious.
The ship becomes very damaged. This seems like super targeted to them. And the crew is ordered to send out signals in any way, like a message in a bottle, just yelling for Prince Namor. Or dolphins, just anybody.
Calling all dolphins.
Whistle for Flipper. Yeah.
So they do. Everyone's just trying to get help. And then Winda sees land. It is a bell-shaped atoll that is making a loud bombing sound. It is so loud that a rock nearby cracks open and a concrete swan appears. So this is just... as they're getting to land. And again, this just feels like Mad Libs.
A concrete swan that then flies away. Yeah.
It was less that boulders fell. It was more that eggs fell.
Were they all eggs?
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. We don't know yet.
Yeah.
And we might never know. But this one was like an egg that
just
had
moving on from
this. Yeah. Had a concrete swan and it soars into the air with no flapping wings. It's just like a static swan that flies. Beb grabs onto it and somehow forgets to let go, and Howard's holding on to Bev, so until it's too late, they're in the air.
Ugly duckling turned into a swan. Is that
maybe?
Is that something?
Just sift for meaning all for the rest of your life in Howard the Duck comics.
It was truly a comic meant for late nights in dorm rooms.
Like I shudder to do mushrooms and read a Howard the Duck. Like I would never do that to myself. I'd be trapped inside of it forever. So the swan drops both Howard and Bev into a pond of quicksand.
Yep.
Everything I describe just sounds like I'm making something new up every page turn. So yep. Then some lizard men, they look like, kind of like Gorn, old Star Trek Gorn.
Yep, totally.
Come to their aid by offering a branch to climb out with. The lizard people all say knees repeatedly.
Like capitalism, you know?
So some lizard men. So as Howard climbs out by grabbing this branch, he encounters this huge, like Conan the Barbarian sized duck. Like buff duck guy.
Oh, buff duck.
It makes me so uncomfortable. It's so weird. Like
humanoid duck. Who says more than just knees. He says that he was only a duck before the doctor gave him knees.
Mm.
N-E-E-Z still. and then we get the big reveal. Bev and Howard meet Dr. Bong. He seems nice. He seems rather pleasant.
That's fair.
Yeah.
I like his belt that reinforces his bell nature.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's like a wrestling. I was going to make Jamie take a swing at this
one. Oh, yeah. Jamie, I think you want to describe. Only fair.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's work from the bottom up. So he's wearing he's wearing Robin Hood boots. They're the brown.
Little swashbuckling boots.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's got some, I would say, lavender pants. Mm-hmm. And then his belt is enormous. That's a big, thick mama jamba of a belt.
It's like he won the wrestling championship.
Yes.
Yeah. With like a weightlifter's belt. Yeah.
With a clip art image of a bell on it. And then a purple sort of top that is covered largely by a red or burgundy kind of colored cape. Quirkily, I would say his hands are what? hooks with dangling balls?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out myself.
Yeah. So one of them is like the, what is the thing inside of a bell that
the
rings?
The clapper?
The clapper. Oh. Yeah. It's the clapper of a bell.
Is that a real thing? Oh, did I just make it up? Okay.
Yeah. And then that's also, is that the thing that, does he have another one, another clapper as like the thing that's holding his
cinching,
cloak?
Yes.
Cinching his cloak.
Yep. And then his head is amazingly a bell.
Yes.
Just a big golden bell.
Just a big golden bell.
With a face on it.
With like the vaguest bit of a face.
It's like if Dr. Doom's mask was a bell.
Right.
It looks like a Tick villain.
Yes.
Like when we 100%. Got here, I was like, oh, this, we seem to have veered into like a chair face Chippendale kind
you
of
are
zone.
That is very astute. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a bell guy. You know,
so
his name is Dr. Bong. What did you think was going to happen?
And there's just a bunch of bonging noises. And
there was certainly a lot of bonging.
Yeah.
Yes.
Involved in this, the production of this,
in the
issue.
Making of this comic.
And yeah. Again, Gerber didn't do drugs.
I mean, that's what we keep
is
hearing.
Is that true?
That's what we keep hearing. But I have not seen that confirmed or denied anywhere. So.
Yeah. So even with the creators we've talked to, like, it seems like that's a regular affirmation. Like,
yeah.
We know Englehart and Jerry Conway and folks like that.
I mean, Jerry
LSD.
Conway has told us stories,
but and wrote comics based on what they did on LSD. But it's not. We don't know what. As far as I know, Steve Gerber was like Ditko-esque in his very weird way.
Yeah, know,
but sober. Yeah, brain chemistry. Who knows? So yeah, what are the thoughts, everybody?
Reading this comic made me feel like I was taking drugs.
Yes.
And I didn't not like it though. It was enjoyable, but it was, you know, you brought up the Mad Libs line, or like the idea that it felt like Mad Libs. That's what I kept thinking about, was just like every page I was just like, all right, where could this possibly go next? And I'm like, I was expecting some level of just regular kind of comic narrative, and that is not what you get here.
No.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
The top hat was really where I thought it was going to peak, but then like by the time like the weird granite like concrete swan comes out of like one of the boulders, I was just like, I don't
what do you want from me?
Here? Yeah,
yeah.
But in an amazing way, and I thought it was amazing and also psychotic, and I loved it.
Yeah, it feels like unfettered psychotic creativity, just like. All right, whatever. I'm on angel dust. Let's do this.
Yeah.
That's it feels very crazy.
It does set up a tone of like literally anything can happen in this comic now.
Right.
Like there's no predicting it.
And it's always been weird. This is just getting weirder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just Howard the Duck as a title, like literally this comic.
Yeah.
This one issue.
As you're turning the pages, you're like, all right, we got a pleasure button now. What's gonna happen next? Who knows? Right.
Yeah, I will say this like hangs together a little bit better than some of the recent ones, which is an amazing sentence. But
yeah, because he turned into the son of Satan, the duck of Satan for a little bit. Like he took Damon Hellstrom's power.
But he was like in a dreamscape for what felt like a very long time. And it was just like very more random than this things were happening.
Yeah.
And this is at least they're on a boat and they're traveling from point A to point B. Like they get to Dr. Bong's island.
Yeah.
That felt like a big win.
A thing happened. Yeah.
Like, you know.
Where is this cruise taking place also? Like, you would think that they would know that they were generally aiming at Dr. Bong's island. They should avoid it.
Right.
I will say, to compliment the art again, Gene Colan draws the hell out of this issue, and Klaus Janson does an amazing job. There is some, like, really, there's, like, single shots of Howard that are so well drawn. It is spectacular. And that one of, like, the boulders dropping, that is a very haunting image.
Yes.
There is some stuff in here where I was just genuinely floored by it. But also there's other times where it's just like, this looks like Bev was drawn by a completely different person, and I don't even know why.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
Do you think that is it is complementary to this book? Like, are they working well together? Because like that's the feeling we're walking away from, or is the art and story?
I think it's supposed to make you feel unsettled, and it's supposed to be surreal. You know, and that's like what, and Colan is great for that.
Yeah.
Also, drawing little funny animals at the same time.
It's true.
Like, that's the fact that there is a Donald Duck-like character that. You don't even think about it especially as you're bouncing around even this one issue, it's like, oh yeah, I forget he's a cigar smoking talking duck.
Right. Like Howard the Duck should be the weirdest part of the Howard the Duck comic.
But it's the most normal.
But it's the most normal part.
Yeah. He's not like top 50 in this one issue.
No, not at all.
I will say, I mean, like, another thing about the art, too, is it kind of grounds all of the stuff. Yeah. So it's just like, this is super weird, but I believe that there's a sea serpent with a top hat because of this.
Yep. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, the duck man is so creepy because it's so realistically rendered. Like, there's a lot of love.
Oh, the big buff duck really affected you.
Yeah, it did, because I was...
All web feet, though.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Web feet,
web hands. Yeah.
Well, because I was like... Oh no, like, is Bev gonna run off with this guy? Like, she's got a thing for ducks, obviously. Like, right. It seems like pretty so direct soft. Competition.
Yeah. So soft and downy.
You're right. That is, we're giving you a great sampling of the 70s right now, David. It's and that is sort of peak crazy 70s. Yeah. Like Gerber doing Man Thing, Gerber doing Howard the Duck. Those are the things that I think most people kind of think of when they're like, it got weird in there, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why.
Have you ever actually seen the issue of this? Like the final printed version? It looks way different in print. I couldn't get access to Marvel Unlimited. So I actually went to my local shop, had a copy of this, and I was like, do you mind if I just flip through this?
Whoa.
And like, it was, the inks were very heavy on that. Maybe it was just because it was like got too much sun or something like that.
Wow.
Also, small fact, random fact in there, that it had in the back, it had a Spalding ad that was drawn by Jack Davis. Do you guys know who Jack Davis is?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
This ad was so beautifully drawn. I'm sorry. It was probably the best drawn thing in a Gene Colan comic. Sorry,
oh my gosh.
Colan.
Wow.
You got to see the Spalding ad. It is incredible. Yeah. Anyways, Jack Davis, good job. So those are my two takeaways from reading the print version.
Nice. I don't think Gene Colan would have been too offended at being compared. It's like Jack Davis is going to come out ahead on this one.
Yeah.
I mean, Jack Davis is an all-time great. So, well, David Herbert, thank you so much for spending time talking about these weird old Marvel comics with us. What can we plug for you? Where can our listeners find you online?
You can find me at sketch.com. It is my Eisner Award nominated. I used to say Eisner losing, and somebody pointed out that it's much nicer to say Eisner Award nominated. Eisner Award nominated subscription comic site. You can find me on my weekly comics interview podcast, Off Panel. When is this going up?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Okay. So around then, I don't want to promise anything, but I have Kieran Gillen coming up. I have Erica Henderson. Jean Luen Yang's coming up. I have regular guests and entering the end of the year stuff. So there should be plenty of celebrating the best and brightest from the year that was in comics. And those are the main places you can find me. I also write for ICV2. And if you really want to follow everything I do, I write a weekly newsletter for my local comic shop, Bosco's Comics in Anchorage, Alaska, where I recommend comics. So
there you go.
Yeah. Cool.
Awesome. Yeah.
I can recommend. I've been a free lurker on much of your stuff for a while because we talked about you regularly, but
yeah.
I'm about to have to turn the corner and become a paid.
Yeah. Yep. I want to also add on with Off Panel. So it's a podcast I listen to every week, whether I'm familiar with the guest or not. It is such a great discovery engine for what is great about comics. I think there's two things that you do really well, David. The first is access. It seems like everyone is up for talking to you, and everyone, you managed to get some great stories and just some of the best interviews out there. You do it at such a high level, especially for comics journalism, that it's just absolutely essential. You're also a really great curator, you have turned me onto so many great things that I've enjoyed reading so much. Like your recommendations, again, even if I'm not familiar, I've picked up things on a whim because you have repped for it so hard, and so far you have not disappointed me, so thank you so much.
Well, you pay me back in full because I got to read that Howard the Duck comic. So, yeah,
cool. Now you're even.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. All right, David, thank you so much. Yeah. An Apple Podcast or whatever you use to listen to us, take a screenshot of your 5-star review, send it to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com with your mailing address. We will put some free stuff in the mail for you. Head over to patreon.com/marvelbythemonth, join as a free member, and get our weekly newsletter. or give us $5 a month to hear an extended version of this episode and our entire bonus feed of over 180 extended and exclusive episodes. Whoa. Or give us $10 a month to become an MBTM insider and be a part of the planning for upcoming episodes. Thank you very much to our MBTM insiders, including
John,
Kevin Moreau,
Sylvia Rayleigh,
Bill E,
Greg Dean Schmitz,
Soren
Martin,
Matt Parks,
Kirk Critton,
Scott Hazelwood,
Ryan Lassiter,
Joe Murray,
RJ Johnson,
Octo,
Elliot Huxtable,
Shadavid,
Nick,
James,
Alan Boone,
Jackson T. Overstreet,
Dave Glowacki,
Ben Potter,
Matt Pennington,
and gorgeous Greggy Rowland.
Yeah.
Find us on Blue Sky at MarvelByTheMonth.com and Instagram at MarvelByTheMonth. Thank you for listening. My name is Brian Stratton.
Mine is Rob Mill.
And I'm Jamie Wenger.
We'll see you next week for the second and final episode of Mortality by the Month. We're wrapping up our coverage of Marvel's War is Hell series. Until then, stay inside and read comics.